From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, officials in New York and several states call for the removal of statues and monuments and other symbols associated with the Confederate States of America after the events in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the governor shooting down New York City Mayor de Blasio's millionaire's tax plan to fund the MTA. And schoolchildren in the state see their Common Core-related test scores inching up. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Officials in New York and several states around the country are calling for the removal of statues and monuments along with the renaming of buildings and streets associated with the Confederate States of America. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
On the heels of events in Charlottesville, Virginia, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo sent a letter to Acting Secretary of the Army Ryan McCarthy, expressing the importance of renaming Stonewall Jackson Drive and General Lee Avenue at Brooklyn's Fort Hamilton. Cuomo, a Democrat, also took to social media, saying, quote, "Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson will be removed from the Cooney Hall of Great Americans because New York stands against racism." Cuomo's tweet drew numerous comments from supporters and dissenters alike. President Donald Trump said on Twitter Thursday he was sad to see United States history torn apart by the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. Albany Common Council President Carolyn McLaughlin is a Democratic mayoral candidate.
This is a conversation that's taking place around the country. It was only a matter of time that we would begin to talk about it here in Albany as it relates to historic monuments here.
Some have called for Albany's Washington Park to be renamed Henry Johnson Memorial Park to honor the African-American World War I hero. Those in favor point out that President Washington owned slaves. Green Party mayoral candidate Dan Platt weighs in.
I wouldn't object to Washington because he owned slaves. Most of the country owned slaves. People in Albany owned slaves. But we should definitely have memorials to those that were enslaved in Albany. So it's not just a matter of tearing down what existed in the past, but also raising up what isn't represented, particularly the struggles of working people, the struggles of the enslaved, and the struggles of native New Yorkers who originally inhabited this land.
The drive to remove all things considered offensive also touched Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie when he suggested that depictions of Confederate flags on a mural in the war room inside the state capitol be removed. Hastie's reaction came from something he heard secondhand. Platt says in these troubled times, context is everything.
In the context of the memorials and the statues that we're talking about are those that glorify and celebrate the war or the war militarism or imperialism.
State Office of General Services spokeswoman Heather Grohl explains the war room painting depicts New York's contributions to the Union cause and its triumph over the Confederacy.
One of the dying rebels, apparently killed by a New Yorker on the battlefield, is clutching a Confederate flag and he is falling backwards. An additional flag, which is in the arched doorway accompanying this part of the mural, is ensconced in a laurel wreath and is depicting a war trophy captured by Union soldiers. Capturing flags as war trophies is common throughout history, and it's clear that this mural in no way honors the Confederate cause. It's quite the opposite.
In Albany's Townsend Park, where a massive anti-KKK rally was held in December, there's a landmark statue Platt believes has a sordid past.
A statue celebrating or memorializing those locally that fought in the Spanish-American War. it has a lot of parallels to the Iraq War. It started on a bunch of lies or exaggerations from the press, corporate press. The occupation of foreign nations, Cuba, Philippines, Hawaii, for decades with brutal fighting, threatening the locals. It was in the name of freeing them, but it was more about corporate power.
McLaughlin says ripples from Virginia have reached New York.
Last night at the council meeting, we did pass a resolution that was unanimously voted and supported by all the council members and myself, denouncing racism, bigotry.
The resolution condemned the Charlottesville incident and voiced the city of Albany's solidarity with the citizens of Charlottesville. McLaughlin would like to strike up dialogue with citizens, politicians, the NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League, the local Jewish community, and other groups. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan was not available for comment. Mayoral candidate Frank Commisso Jr. could not be reached for comment.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Well, Alan, this week, what seems to be a continuing fight with New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo continued. Mayor de Blasio's idea to help with the transportation, quote, summer of hell, is to have a millionaire's tax and fund the MTA. The governor has shot that down.
That's right. And that fight goes on a number of different levels. It's like playing three-dimensional chess, David. One of the other places that we are seeing this is this whole question of congestion pricing, which is how do you stop people from overwhelming Manhattan traffic? That is, they build these humongous buildings for more and more apartments. Cuomo, of course, believes that you could do congestion pricing by charging people to come in from the outer boroughs like Queens and Brooklyn and Richmond and charging them on bridges that had been free up until now, and that would discourage more people from coming in. But of course, they'd have to get on the subways, and we know this is the summer from hell on the subways. So there are a lot of people sort of shaking their heads at that one, although Mayor Bloomberg wanted that too, and it got shot down, mainly because a lot of people are coming in from places like New Jersey and other places and in order to commute. And legislators from those places will not like the idea that their constituents are going to be unhappy because they have to pay too much to get into Manhattan, which I should say is known basically as the city. It's ridiculous, of course, because Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island and the Bronx are all part of the city. But when I grew up in the city, I can tell you, when my friend said they're going to the city to visit Shattuck, they meant Manhattan.
So let's continue with what has occurred, and that was in Charlottesville, Virginia. The ripple effect all across the country, including in New York State, where we're hearing about monuments and statues and flags and all sorts of things being taken down or being asked to take down. And this has got politicians making decisions.
Well, that's right. For example, there is now a move, apparently, to take down the statue of Christopher Columbus in the center of Manhattan on 59th, as we all know, Central Park West and intersection Broadway. It's been a monument for a long, long time, and there's no question that Columbus coming to America hurt the Native American population. You can't get around it. Nevertheless, there will be people who say, oh, come on, you know, it's just a statue and all the rest. In addition, we see that the governor of New York has suggested that Robert E. Lee's Road in a military facility be changed, the name be changed. People are piling on. As Donald Trump himself has said, George Washington was a slaveholder. So was Thomas Jefferson. And we've known about this for years. So people will have to decide whether or not this is really the fight that they want to be working on. I heard Andrew Young, the former ambassador of the United Nations and a brilliant thinker, saying this is all a distraction from the real thing that people of color and others and the poor should be thinking about.
Let's go to Donald Trump for a minute. He held a rally in Phoenix, Arizona, where, among other things, he went directly after the press. This is not new. He's called the New York Times the failing New York Times. Nevertheless, the newspaper of record and one that many people would say would be one of the best in the world is under attack.
Look, let's face it. You just said it. The New York Times is the best newspaper in the world. There's nothing like it. When I got to Great Britain for the first time and I began to read the British press, which I'd always been told was extremely serious, it doesn't hold a candle to the Times. That doesn't mean I don't have issues with the Times from time to time, but we know it. And we know that the Times is the best, the Washington Post is the best and is right up there and has been demeaned by Trump, who says it's from that they're the ambassador or whatever from, you know, from Amazon because Bezos owns both of them. I do think that that's where we're going, by the way. I think we're going to, in the same way that the NPR model is people put their pennies in to support it, the same thing is going to happen for other news organizations. And the Times, of course, if you scroll down, when you're getting the overnight edition, as I do on your device, it always says, you know, you can support the Times, and you can do that. So I can only say it's nonsense. Trump is, of course, making up what was called the big lie, and we've seen it in history again and again. You just keep saying lies, and there will always be some people who believe it, some because they want to, some because they're dumb.
Another iconic media publication, New York, announced that it will be going paperless. It's the Village Voice.
Well, there are those people, and I respect them greatly, who say that eventually there will be no more newsprint. People will not be reading newspapers. We know that young people don't do it. And you go online, the newspaper that I invented years ago, the Legislative Gazette, did the same thing. We said, okay, it's costing us a fortune to print on paper. We'll go online. We'll reduce our costs by an awful lot. We did, and it's been a very successful experiment by going in that way. The Village Voice, of course, has such nostalgia for so many of us who grew up in New York City and who depended on the Voice. For example, the reporting on state government and local government by Wayne Barrett was exemplary. It was nothing like it. Jack Newfield, who was in my class at Hunter College, long passed on, was a staple in terms of doing investigative and charismatic type reporting. So the Village Voice as a print staple will be missed. I hope whoever's owning it these days will be able to keep it going online.
Finally, Alan, our Karen DeWitt has a story this week about the results of this year's Common Core-related standardized test showing that scores for New York's children have inched up. The issue, of course, with the standardized test in the past has been the boycott. About a fifth of the children boycotted the tests altogether. And the issue of trying to standardize education is something that's been debated for a long time in New York.
Look, the reading scores have gone up. The math scores have not. So what's new? The idea that our schools are not performing where they should be is so. Look, there are inner city schools which are just not being able to do as much as if you want to send your kid to a private or independent school. We've always known that. One of the reasons that charter schools make an argument is that, or that an argument is made for charter schools, is that you give students a choice and their parents a choice. There's no question that a lot of people want to send their kids to charter schools. There are long waiting lists in many of them. And, you know, I get that part of it. I also have big issues with charter schools in that I think the name of the game is to make our regular schools better. And that's the way that we all learned about charter schools in the beginning. They were going to set examples. But the examples they're setting are not extraordinarily different from what we're seeing in our regular so-called public schools. Well, not what we're seeing in the, quote, other public schools, because charter schools insist that they be called public schools. And I'm a big believer that students should have choices if they can. If you were upper middle class, growing up in Manhattan where I did, your parents may have sent you to Horace Mann, and you had a choice, or to another school, or to Columbia Grammar, or to any of those places. There was always Stuyvesant and Science and Brooklyn Tech for kids who were very, very bright and who could do that. But not everybody could. So the idea that we have to continue to marshal our resources for schools and to make sure that we're getting our money's worth from them is beyond debate. We need to do that because kids are our future.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chertok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The result of this year's Common Core-related standardized test shows scores for New York's school children inching up. Around one-fifth of the children boycotted the test altogether due to continued controversy over the Common Core learning standards. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt explains.
State Education Commissioner Mary Ellen Elia says she's pleased with the progress made in the 2017 test results. While scores improved by nearly 2% from last year, the results still show that around 60% of students in grades 3 through 8 are not considered proficient in English and math. Elia says she's keeping her eye on the big picture, though, and trying to see the positive in the results.
We have some areas that we certainly need. We know that we need to have growth, but we are on a trajectory of moving forward and upward, and that's a good thing.
She says in New York City and in upstate's largest cities, there was slight improvement. Children of all ethnicities perform better on the 2017 test than they did in 2016. But there's still a large gap in the test scores of children from richer schools, where around two-thirds scored highly on the tests, and the results in poorer schools. Around one-third of children in rural districts and in New York City were considered proficient in the skills they need in English and math, while just an average of 16% of students in upstate city schools performed well on the tests.
The issue of gaps between students across the state is a major focus.
The test results come amid ongoing controversy over the Common Core learning standards and the related exams. The animosity between teachers, parents, and education leaders has calmed somewhat under Elia's now two-year-old tenure. The new commissioner went on a statewide listening tour to hear complaints. The Board of Regents, which sets education policy in New York, has gained new members who are skeptical of Common Core. And there's been a moratorium on the test results being used to negatively evaluate students or their teachers. But the state's largest teachers union, New York State United Teachers, called the 2017 test results virtually meaningless. NYSET President Andy Pallotta, speaking before the test results were released, said the tests are part of what is a broken system.
It has created a system where folks just see themselves as preparing students for tests, not preparing students for life. And I believe that that's what their real goal is. So the test had become all important.
Commissioner Elia, who began her career as a teacher, says the tests are being revamped. Teachers will have more input into the test design and questions in future years.
The Board of Regents voted to move from a three-day for English language arts to two and a three-day in mathematics to two. So ultimately, those designs for tests will change. There will be fewer questions, and those questions will be focused on a two-day period.
But Elia says the test will still be just as rigorous. Commissioner Elia and the Board of Regents are revising the teacher and principal evaluations for the fifth time since 2010. Pallotta with NYSET says there's a lot riding on the reforms, including whether the test boycott movement will continue. While the number of children who skipped the test in 2017 was 19%, down 2 percentage points from 2016, Pallotta doesn't believe the opt-outs will truly end until parents and teachers are satisfied with the changes.
A lot of parents are waiting to see what New York State, the education officials in this state, what the legislature will do to address their concerns.
Meanwhile, the leaders of the state's charter schools say they are pleased. They say the test results show that charter school students scored higher on the exams than did public school students. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The formal renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, began in Washington recently. The trade talks are being closely watched along the northern border of New York and the rest of the country, where trade with Canada is a critical economic driver. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley has more.
President Donald Trump has called NAFTA the worst trade pact in history. In a statement, the U.S. trade negotiator said the Trump administration believes, quote, NAFTA has fundamentally failed many, many Americans and needs major improvement, unquote. But Canadian and Mexican negotiators say NAFTA is an economic success that needs to be updated to reflect economic and technological changes. As the posturing flares, economic entities along the northern border are watching to see just how negotiations will change the pact that has guided cross-border trade for 23 years. Plattsburgh North Country Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Gary Douglas says the U.S.-Canada economic partnership is the single largest driving force in northern New York's economy.
It's very much in the consciousness here in the North Country. Because of who our business's customers are, where their supply chains are, it is the overwhelmingly dominant factor in the economy of the entire region. So they're watching, they're reading about it, they're curious, a little bit concerned, but those concerns would only grow if we start to hear things that seem to be taking the conversations off track, and hopefully that won't be the case. But it is very much in the consciousness of business here. As opposed to, say, if you were in Pennsylvania or Virginia or Iowa, it probably wouldn't be.
A.N. Deringer is a customs brokerage and supply chain management firm. Director of Compliance and Customs Affairs Amy Magnus says her clients want certainty in trade agreements.
I think reasonable people right now are withholding any particular judgment. There has been a pattern of sort of bombast, you know, in the news, but even I am not seeing a real substantial rehaul of NAFTA. There are so many aspects of this trade agreement that have been beneficial, I think, to all three nations that I think that, you know, there'll be some smoothing out, but I'm certainly hopeful that there will not be huge changes that disrupt the current benefits that I think all three nations have enjoyed. Admitting that there are some areas that could use some adjustment.
Can-Am Border Trade Alliance President and CEO Jim Phillips says negotiators must be careful to balance the trade agreement.
NAFTA is a very critical issue in terms of North America being the global engine of the future. However, I do think that we are all going to hopefully benefit from a renegotiated NAFTA. I think that there were some unintended consequences and some surprises that occurred in the original NAFTA that need to be kind of balanced in terms of making sure that the agreement is fair. NAFTA does need to be adjusted to result in a fair balance between Canada, United States, and Mexico.
The North American Free Trade Agreement was signed in 1992, replacing a previous Canadian Free Trade Agreement and adding Mexico.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1734. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.